Welcome back to the program. We used to worry that schools were inadequate to the 20th century, that a system built around an agrarian calendar and 19th century ideas was inadequate to the reality of the late 20th century. Today, the disruptive impact of technology, information, and globalization has once again transformed our society, and as we move into the second decade of the 21st century, we are still bogged down by some of those old 19th century ideas of education. Quite simply, do we have the momentum and the energy to reach escape velocity from these old ideas? Few have been more at the forefront of that effort to reach that escape velocity than our guest today, Tony Wagner. He's the first Innovation Education Fellow at the Technology and Entrepreneurship Center at Harvard. He consults widely to public and independent schools and foundations around the country. He's a senior advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's the author of the best-selling The Global Achievement Gap. And it is my pleasure to welcome Tony Wagner to this program today to talk about his newest work, Creating Innovators, The Making of Young People Who Will Change the World. Tony Wagner, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. It does seem that we have two hurdles to overcome. That in the global achievement gap, you talked about a lot of the changes that we needed to make to simply get up to speed. And in this new look at innovation, you take it even further, and it's hard to imagine us getting to the second stage when we haven't fully gotten to the first stage yet.
Well, I agree with you, but one thing that has changed since I wrote The Global Achievement Gap 4 years ago, and that is the global meltdown. I think what more and more people are beginning to understand is that an economy like ours, which is driven primarily by consumption, and that consumption in turn is fueled by people going into debt, is simply not sustainable. It's not sustainable economically, environmentally, spiritually. And so I think there is a new openness to considering if, in fact, we have to transition from a consumer-driven economy to a more innovation-driven economy, what must we do differently as parents, teachers, mentors, and employers?
And as we look around the world, though, where that old infrastructure didn't exist, I mean, cell phones are a great example. If we look at the developing world right now, we look at Asia, we see cell phones as the current technology. They didn't have to go through all the other steps to get there.
Well, that's right. Finland is a wonderful example. Since I was last on your show, Bob Compton and I did a documentary film about Finland's education system, which is the best in the world. And they transitioned from a poor agrarian economy 40 years ago with an underperforming education system to now the best education system in the world and one of the economies that is the most driven by innovation and entrepreneurship. And in a sense, they did skip a step because they didn't try to make the system they had incrementally better. They realized they had to transform it if they were going to come into the 21st century. So they had a shared sense of urgency and were able to sort of envision a dramatically better system.
One of the things you talk about as an important aspect of innovation is this willingness to use trial and error, not be risk avoidant. And that, in many ways, is what we have to do as we approach the whole educational system.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, Microsoft's R&D budget is 17%. Cisco's is 13%. 3M, a manufacturing company, is 6%. Then you have Google with their 20% rule, where people can work a day a week on any project of their choice. We have no educational R&D, or very, very little. You know, there in Napa, where you are, you have the new tech schools, which were founded there. And I think schools like that are doing very important educational R&D, but they're scraping for the money. There is no support from the state or the feds. And so we need a serious and sustained policy of investing in educational R&D because there's no change without R&D.
It also is an issue of changing the culture, as you talk about, that the culture of schooling really is at odds with the culture of innovation.
Well, that's what I really discovered in writing this new book. You know, I wrote about the 7 survival skills for careers, college, and citizenship in my last book, The Global Achievement Gap. And then when the economy collapsed and I saw college kids with BA degrees seemingly having most of those skills anyway, coming home and finding no job, I was forced to ask myself, are those skills enough? And what I came to understand is that if, in fact, we're really going to develop the qualities of young people to be innovators, we need to understand, how do we do that? How do we create an innovator? So I interviewed these very, very innovative young people in their 20s from a wide variety of fields, STEM fields, arts, social entrepreneurship. I then interviewed their parents. I then interviewed the teacher or mentor who told me, the kids told me, had made the greatest difference in their lives. And I found a consistent pattern. Every one of those teachers was an outlier, teaching in very different ways than his or her colleagues.
The key part of this is that, you know, you were talking about a consumer society before and moving away from that. We're also moving away from the idea of students as merely consumers of knowledge, that in fact, knowledge is a free commodity today.
Well, that's exactly the premise. Right now, knowledge is like air. It's like water. There is no value added to knowing more than the person next to you because, you know, he or she will Google it and figure it out pretty quick. The world does not care what our students know. The world cares what our students can do with what they know. And that is a matter of skill and will. And that's a completely different education challenge than the one we've been focused on, which is premised on the idea of knowledge scarcity, and the only way you get knowledge is through the teacher. So these outlier teachers whom I described understood that, you know, a classroom that teaches innovation, students have to create, not merely consume. Students have to learn to take risks, fail, make mistakes, and start over, as opposed to being penalized for failure. They have to learn to real teamwork as well as individual work. And finally, and most importantly, these teachers develop the intrinsic motivations of these young people, as did the parents.
Talk about these intrinsic motivations, because one of the things that you talk about that we're seeing so much of today is kids that really want to make a difference. As Steve Jobs put it, kids that want to put a ding in the universe.
Well, you're exactly right. Every one of these young innovators whom I interviewed, from a wide variety of circumstances, some privileged, some from disadvantaged backgrounds, every single one of them was committed to making some kind of difference in the world. All of them were far more intrinsically motivated, wanting to make a difference more than they wanted to make money. And then when I really explored what did their parents do, what did their teachers and mentors do to further develop that intrinsic motivation, I saw a pattern. The pattern was play to passion to purpose. Parents encouraging much more exploratory, discovery-based play, didn't schedule their kids' days up to the hilt, but at the same time kind of offered a rich buffet of options for these kids in order for them to better explore and understand what is it they're passionate about, what is it they're really interested in. And these parents valued these kids finding their passions and pursuing them more than just academic achievement for its own sake, as did the teachers, allowing time in their classes for projects and research that were student-initiated and student-driven. And as I followed the evolution of these young innovators, in every case, their passions morphed. They changed, they evolved, and to the point where, as young adults, it became more of a deeper sense of purpose, of wanting to give back, make a difference in the world, values that both parents and teachers had encouraged and reinforced.
And is this something that is true or that needs to be true across the board? Is this something we need to be looking at with respect to all students?
Well, I think this is a critical point. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, not everybody's going to be the next Steve Jobs. Well, of course they're not. Not everybody's going to be a brilliant innovator. But what is clear is that kids are born creative, curious, imaginative. They're born with kind of qualities that enable them to be more innovative in whatever it is they do. And to the extent that we are more intentional as parents, as teachers, as mentors and employers, in keeping those qualities alive, encouraging them and nurturing them, I am absolutely persuaded from this research that young people can be more imaginative, more creative, and more innovative in whatever it is they do, and that's going to be both personally more rewarding and satisfying to them. They'll be creators, not consumers. And secondly, it's going to be a significant impact on our economy.
Do we have a problem in that these kids that we're talking about have grown up as digital natives? They're in a world of instant gratification where they're always connected. And they're being taught by a generation that is in many ways removed from it and in many ways doesn't understand it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a double-edged sword. You're absolutely right. They're digital natives. They're growing up far more connected and informed. They use the web to connect, to create, to collaborate. To teach themselves. It's self-directed learning when they follow these links. They Google stuff just for fun. You know, I sometimes see kids in the back of a classroom Googling what the teacher is talking about to see if it's still true. But the point here is that this is also a generation that is, according to latest studies, spending an average of 7.5 hours on their electronic devices after school. They, I think, are going to both have to be taught how to use technology effectively in the classroom, how to do an effective Google search, internet search, how to use the tools of collaboration like Google Docs, how to maintain a digital portfolio, which I think every kid should start school with beginning in first grade. They need all of those opportunities, but at the same time, it's a generation that I think will need to be taught how not to multitask, how to understand the addictive qualities of these technologies, and most importantly, how to develop the muscles of perseverance and sustained concentration, which are essential for any serious intellectual or creative work. So in a sense, each generation, I think, has something to learn from and gain from the other.
One of the things that you talk about is these kids today developing a different way of looking at the world, habits of mind, I think you talk about, in terms of the way they question what's going on around them.
Well, you know, it's a generation, and we've seen this now successively, really since the 60s, it's a generation skeptical of adult authority. A lot of these kids have learned the things that they value most highly from peers. Certainly they've learned how to use technology from their peers, not from the adults. So on the one hand, they're skeptical of adult authority. They refuse to be talked down to or talked at. But on the other hand, they really do seek more kind of mentoring and coaching from adults who are more willing to engage in an authentic kind of relationship, less power-based.
Is there a core curriculum that we are losing in this, a sense of humanity that is important still?
Boy, you ask the greatest and most important questions. This is not a matter of content versus skills, a kind of a polarized way of looking at the argument that many people push. It's both. Of course, there's such a thing as cultural literacy. Of course, there is enjoyment of academic content for its own sake. All important. But content can no longer be the goal of education, because it's growing exponentially, it's changing constantly, and it's on every internet-connected device. As I said before, the world does not care what our students know. The world cares what they can do with what they know, and that's skill, and that's will. And so I think education, and any good class, does both. Exposes kids to content for a variety of reasons, so they can have a sense of what's out there, so they can have a sense of cultural literacy and a foundation for continuous learning. But on the other hand, routinely gives them opportunities to use that content to explore things that are of interest to them and to combine content. We haven't talked about the interdisciplinary nature of this, but you know, these innovators' classrooms are problem-based learning focused and using multiple disciplines to understand. As Judy Gilbert, director of talent at Google, said to me, if there's one thing educators must understand, it's that problems can neither be solved nor even understood within the bright lines of individual academic disciplines.
And yet we are still siloing those academic disciplines all the way through college and graduate school.
Well, that's right. And that's another one of the, I think, problems with our high school college system, is that we reward and incent specialization. The high school universe is divided and conquered by something we call Carnegie units, a system that's now about 120 years old. Yet the best high schools that I profiled in the last book, The Global Achievement Gap, and the college programs that I profile in this new book, all offer these kind of more problem-based, interdisciplinary approaches to learning and to creating and to solving problems.
Talk about the colleges, because we often think of them as these places of innovation and creativity, and in fact, sometimes the opposite is true.
Well, this is one of the things that shocked me. You know, I went into this research 3 years ago with the kind of conventional assumption that, of course, our major research one universities are kind of engines of innovation. And yet, when I interviewed these students and the teachers who'd had the greatest impact on them, teachers from Harvard, MIT, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, Tulane, I found that every single one of them was an outlier because of the ways in which they were teaching, number one. None of them had tenure, number two, nor were they going to get tenure because they were much more focused on really exploring what young people can do with what they've learned. Ed Carrier is a perfect example. Down here at Stanford, he's been here teaching, I think, almost 20 years. He runs something called the Smart Product Design Lab, teaching kids to combine mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, computer science, building robots. He has spawned more kind of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, arguably, than any other teacher in the university. Yet his title is Professor of Practice. He has no tenure. He has to scrounge from his alums every single year for money to keep his lab going. And it's simply that our university's cash cow, if you will, is pure academic research. And they really slight the people who are really working with master's degree students versus doctoral students. And master's degree students are going to go out and change the world and start new businesses. So I think our academic priorities are very, very badly skewed, not just at Stanford, but every other place I mentioned, same problem.
And one of the things we see as a result of this is some of the great innovators, people like Steve Jobs and Michael Dell and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, all being college dropouts.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, they're voting with their feet. They're telling us something. They're saying their studies are interfering with their education. And all of them need more teachers like Ed Carrier or like Amy Smith at MIT or Paul Bottino at Harvard. These were all teachers who have made a critical difference in the lives of these young innovators whom I interviewed. And yet, as I said, all of them outliers in their institutions.
One of the things we see, though, is that the preparation for all of this starts early on. And part of it starts in these kids in high school preparing themselves for what they think will be required to get into college.
Well, you know, that's absolutely the case. I speak to a lot of parent audiences. I spoke here in Palo Alto to a parent audience at the girls' middle school. I'm speaking tonight to parents at the Bing Nursery School here at Stanford, and last week it was Atlanta. Parents, I think, are very frightened. They believe that, and I think correctly, that the world is a much more competitive place than it used to be. They think that if they get their kids into a name-brand college, that they're going to have a competitive advantage. That's a myth, though, I think. What many parents don't fully understand is that it is far, far harder to get kids into a select college now than it was even a decade ago. It is a global marketplace. The applicant pool has grown exponentially. Point one. Point two is that it matters less where kids go to undergraduate school. It actually matters more where they go to graduate school. And that the student who graduates having had good summer internships where they really had an opportunity to find and pursue a passion, I'm talking about graduating high school now, had some opportunities to discover their interests, who can talk knowledgeably in an interview about what it is they want to create, what it is they want to learn and do, and who also can talk about mistakes they've made and what they've learned from them. That student, maybe with a 3.5 GPA, will actually be far better prepared for the world and more likely to be successful than the kid who has a 4.0 GPA, has never failed, and really doesn't know who or what he or she is in terms of interest.
You talk about the way this has played out in Finland, for example, where kids don't necessarily have to be on a college track, but there's a real bifurcation of success in any case.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because this is another key challenge for us here in America. Finland, as I mentioned, arguably the best education system in the world by any standard, also one of the strongest economies in the world. Every kid gets the identical same education from first grade to ninth grade. The variation between the best and worst schools in Finland is less than 4%. So they're getting high-quality, consistent education. Beginning in 10th grade, students have a choice between an academic track and a career vocational track, which has been developed in close collaboration with businesses. 45% of the kids choose the career vocational track because they know it leads to a good job right out of high school. Both tracks lead to post-secondary. Kids can go to post-secondary regardless of which track. But the point is, not every kid can, should, or needs to go to a four-year university, and we need to understand the dignity of work in this country does not necessarily require a white collar. Parents are going to have to, I think, embrace the fact that some of their kids are going to choose to be chefs, electricians, plumbers, auto mechanics, and interestingly, those jobs are not going to be offshored or automated anytime soon.
But the preparation, though, for those careers and for the citizenship that society requires are equally powerful.
Well, that's the point. Well, regardless of the track, regardless of where you're going, you still need the seven survival skills that I describe. You need to be able to think critically and solve problems. You need to be able to collaborate. and lead peers. You need to take initiative. You need to be entrepreneurial. You need to be agile and adaptable. You need to access and analyze information, communicate effectively. Those are core competencies for all citizens, for every human being, that every high school student must be well on the way of to mastering, regardless of what track he or she may be in.
Talk a little bit about the collaboration, because it is a big part of this, and yet in some ways it runs so antithetical to the individualistic culture that we are surrounded with.
Yeah. Well, you know, Susan Cain wrote this book about quiet, and it's caused an interesting controversy. She argues that, in fact, collaboration has become groupthink, that all creative work is really done in solitude. I don't think it's an either-or. I think she further polarizes this. Of course, a degree of solitude is essential for any kind of creative work. You know, I can't imagine writing a book sitting around a table with three or four other people doing stuff, right? But, you know, I needed help writing this book. I reached out to business people. I reached out to students who could be my research associates. I had a whole team working with me because the problem was too complex for me to try to understand and solve all by myself. And Tim Brown, CEO of the design company IDEO, mm-hmm. right here in the Valley, says exactly the same thing. He says, innovation demands teamwork because problems are too complex to be understood in isolation and alone. So I think it's actually both that we need. We need to encourage a degree of solitude and reflection, and certainly a kind of individual achievement ethic has its place. But conversely, we must understand that innovation is a team sport.
Can we get to this place in incremental steps?
Well, here's my view. It goes back to what I suggested before about R&D. The first and most important step is to design an accountability system that incents the right kind of teaching and learning. We have accountability 1.0 right now, right? And what are we doing? We are using multiple choice factual recall tests that tell us nothing about college, career, and citizenship readiness. Schools can make what's called AYP, adequate yearly progress, and fail their kids. Fail them because they're not teaching the skills, because the skills aren't on the tests. So the first and most important challenge is for us to create a new alliance of business leaders, community leaders, and educators who advocate for an accountability system that measures the skills that matter most. Now, the tests are out there, something called the College and Work Readiness Assessment, an online test of critical thinking, analytic reasoning, problem solving, and writing. It's an outstanding test. It's been around for a decade. More and more people are using it. That could be used at a state level. Every kid, as I mentioned, should have a digital portfolio. You want to know the quality of a good teacher? Don't assess a teacher according to a silly little test that's given for 2 hours once a year. That tells us nothing. I want to look at the student's body of work over that year. I can tell who's teaching and who's not by seeing what did students produce in September, and now let me see the progress in their work in June. That's the sensible kind of accountability system. So all of that, I think, requires, again, a kind of R&D approach to education for the 21st century. We have to first be very, very clear. What are the outcomes that matter most? What must 18-year-olds know and be able to do for college, careers, and citizenship in the 21st century? And then secondly, what kinds of assessments will tell us if we're making progress? And right now, we don't have either. We have neither the agreement on the goal, nor do we have the assessments to measure what matters most.
And, of course, the overlay to all of this is that as we're trying to make this incremental progress, the world underneath us is constantly shifting as well.
Well, this is what people need to understand. You know, there's somewhat of a naive belief that our education problem is really it's simply about bringing our disadvantaged students up to the levels of our good middle-class students in schools. People don't realize that while as late as 1995, we were number one in college completion in the world, today we are 15th in the world. And our international scores are horrendous. And one of the main reasons is because the rest of the world is using assessments, the PISA assessment, Program for International Student Assessment, that is a primarily open-ended, what we call a constructed response test that tests students' abilities to apply what they've learned, not merely regurgitate it. And so, once again, we come back to the challenge of assessments and other countries' understanding and being quite far ahead of us in realizing the need to transform their education system.
Tony Wagner, the book is Creating Innovators, the Making of Young People Who Will Change the World. Tony, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, I enjoyed it so much. And do remind readers about the wonderful videos that are embedded throughout the book. It's not just a book about innovation.
Talk about those QR codes.
You know, I collaborated with Bob Compton on this documentary film called The Finland Phenomenon. This was a year and a half ago. We were sitting around in Singapore visiting schools together a year ago, and he said, you know, you can't just write a book about innovation, Tony. It has to be innovative. So he persuaded me and my publisher to embed in the book a series of QR codes. There are more than 60 of them. And he then proceeded to spend 8 months of his time shooting 150 hours of video, which he edited down into 1 to 1.5 minute segments, which when you scan those QR codes with your phone, up pops the video. It's really fabulous. People can see the trailer for the book, the video trailer for my book, on my website, TonyWagner.com.
Tony Wagner, Creating Innovators, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Great questions.